From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. In recent weeks, people have been complaining about getting political ads in the mail. That's nothing new for this time of year, but what is new in these cases is that what were effectively campaign ads were made to look like newspapers. They've been delivered to mailboxes across Chicago and the suburbs. The papers and corresponding websites are the product of a company called Local Government Information Services, or LGIS. It was founded in 2016 by the conservative activist, gubernatorial candidate, former gubernatorial candidate, and conservative radio host Dan Proft. And LGIS purports to be a, quote, real media watchdog, unquote. But it has sparked backlash for the content that spread misinformation and targeted Democratic politicians. Governor J.B. Pritzker has characterized the content as racist and right-wing, which prompted a swift rebuke from Proft on Twitter, who accused the governor, in turn, of using that as an excuse to avoid debating the merits of the message on crime and other topics. 34 publications with names like the McHenry Times, the Kane County Reporter, Chicago City Wire, the Shambana Sun, and the DuPage Policy Journal are all part of the LGIS network. More recently, it emerged that the postage permit on the front of the papers that were sent out is registered to Paddock Publications Incorporated, best known as the publisher of the Daily Herald newspaper in the Chicago suburbs. Paddock faced backlash for printing the papers, including from Governor Pritzker's re-election campaign, which backed out of a forum hosted by the Daily Herald. That all culminated last Thursday when Paddock announced it was dropping the contract to print LGIS papers. The forum is back on, and Proft, for his part, has said Paddock has been replaced by the printer, or excuse me, Paddock has been replaced as the printer by a bigger operation, and the distro of newspapers will increase. These publications are often referred to as pink slime, and we'll get into why, but for now know that that term was coined by a journalist called Ryan Zitgraff. A decade ago, he worked at a company in this space called Journatic, and he joins us now. Ryan, welcome to The 21st Show. Thanks for being here today.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Alyssa Kaplan. She's the executive director of the nonpartisan and nonprofit research and political advocacy group Reform for Illinois. Alyssa, welcome to The 21st Show.
It's great to be here.
And finally, Melita Garza also joins us. She's a historian of journalism and an associate professor in the College of Media at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Melita, good to have you with us as well.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
And listeners, we want to hear from you as ever, especially if you have been receiving these publications. Maybe you've seen some of these stories online shared by one of these outlets. The Sangamo Sun is a number. Another one, Shambana Sun, I mentioned, they're all over the state. You can join us by calling 800-222-9455. What are you seeing out there in this regard? 800-222-9455. Or tweet us at 21st Show, at 21ST Show. All right, Ryan, you are credited with coining the term pink slime journalism, and I do want to come back to whether the term journalism is appropriate there, but for now, for listeners unfamiliar with that, what exactly are these publications? Where does that name come from?
So, yeah, again, 10 years ago, I was working for this company, Journatic, and at the time, they were employing workers, journalists in the Philippines and other countries, yet they were writing about news that was going on in Chicago, Houston, and New York. Now, as an editor, my job was to give them American sounding bylines and to disguise it, to make it seem like it was part of the regular news. But I felt it was deceptive. So I was a whistleblower for that company. And when I was blowing the whistle and writing about it, I came up with the term pink slime journalism because at that time, there was a report about this bad meat, this sort of inferior product that was being placed in your hamburgers. And it was deceptive because they just called it part of the hamburger, but it turns out that it was just this byproduct. So that's the term that I came up with at the time.
So the idea being that instead of fully meat hamburgers, you're getting part meat, part pink slime. And so I guess that was the idea with these supposed news outlets, that it was partly news and maybe a little bit of pink slime in there as well, I guess.
That they weren't totally upfront about what kind of news that they are giving their consumers.
Yeah. And you people in the, and I now you're, it's all coming back to me. I think I actually might have worked for a newspaper that was exploring some relationship with Jurnatic at the time. People in the, they could get, you know, press releases, or maybe even, were they watching city council meetings from the Philippines and writing up reports, or how did that process work?
Yeah, sometimes that did happen where, you know, half a world away, there'd be somebody watching a video version or just reading the minutes of a meeting and then writing up a news story as if they were actually there, but they weren't. So it would be very one-sided and very, you know, just not actual much journalism to it, just sort of reproducing notes.
Okay. So that's the origin story here. Alyssa, let me bring you into the conversation now. Alyssa Kaplan with Reform for Illinois. Can you tell us more about some of the stories that were recently featured in these publications?
Yeah, there have been stories focusing on a number of different Republican or Democratic candidates or elected officials. Generally, the coverage of the Republican officials is positive, depending on who's running in the primary and who the paper might be supporting. And the coverage of the Democratic officials or candidates is negative and might emphasize things like their perceived connection to increasing crime rates or high taxes or things like that. Sometimes there were press releases. There are press releases that seem to be, you know, pretty much just inserted into the paper, sometimes from elected officials as well. So that type of content.
What do the publications purport to have any sort of core beliefs or standards that they adhere to?
Yeah, the leaders of the corporation and the publishers have been fairly transparent about their beliefs. Brian Timponi, who's one of the president of LGIS, has said that he's a conservative guy and he doesn't make any bones about it. And he said that, you know, all newspapers are an election tool and that they're just transparent about it. If you go on the website of the LGIS and look at their About Us section, it will say that the most donor information we can get on there is that the papers are supported by advocacy groups who share beliefs in limited government or something to that effect. So in terms of the slant, when they're actually asked, they're fairly open about it, but that information is not necessarily clear from just reading these newspapers. Alleged newspapers.
Sure, right. And their names are intentionally made to sound like sort of the traditional heralds and posts and things like that of the newspaper industry, as opposed to, you know, conservative news or something like that that would be a little more transparent in the title. Melita Garza, let me bring you into the conversation now. We've been using the term pink slime journalism to talk about this, and we actually had a conversation among myself and the producers of this show this morning about whether to use the word journalism in this conversation. Is this journalism?
Well, if you look at the standard definition of journalism, which Kovach and Rosenstiel argued for in the book, The Elements of Journalism, the purpose of journalism is to provide people with the information they need to be self-governing. In other words, the information that they need to be free. It's hard to see how such one-sided and in many cases lacking in any factual basis information actually constitutes journalism, or could therefore be something that people could actually use to make solid decisions going forward. So I would say no.
Okay. You're a historian of journalism, though. Are there parallels between these pink slime publications and journalism of the past, maybe the yellow journalism era, for example? And you might need to explain what I'm talking about to our listeners there.
Oh, well, thank you so much for opening the door to history here. And actually, we're going to go way further back than the penny press. We're going to go back to before the founding of the Republic. And if you can imagine yourself in the spring of 1782, that may be hard to do, but we're in the spring of 1782, and
I've got the Hamilton soundtrack playing in the back of my head. Okay.
Okay. And so we have the famous Benjamin Franklin is working on our behalf to get a good settlement for the United States and for its founding in the Treaty of Paris. And what does he decide to do? He decides that he's going to start develop a fictional supplement, but present it as a real newspaper. And in this supplement, he puts two articles. One of them is a letter from John Paul Jones. Yes, that John Paul Jones, stating how poorly the British have treated American prisoners of war during the Revolutionary War. That is not true. He did not actually write that letter. And the other article is an article that was based on a letter that a U.S. or what would become the U.S. A revolutionary officer wrote, writing about a bag of information and actually skulls that he found that was going to be sent to the British governor of Canada. And it was several bags of skulls that purported to be skulls of American farmers and children and housewives who were killed by Indians who were working at the behest of the British powers to help defeat the revolutionary forces. Anyway, a big smear both on Native Americans and on the British. And the whole goal he had in the supplement was to make the British look bad so that he could extract higher reparations from Britain in the Treaty of Paris for their treatment of the United States during the war, which of course they lost. Now he used a real newspaper name, but it was a fake supplement. He sent it off to some friends who ran newspapers in New England. And he said, you know, there's some truth to this. It may not be 100% accurate, but there's some truth to this. And so in fact, this news was reprinted. And so it is actually not reported as a hoax for 70 years. So you can see that that we have a long history of this kind of
fake news and alternative facts at the founding of the Republic, it sounds like. Let's take it back to the present day, though. And Ryan, let me ask you about the broader landscape. Ryan Zagreff, a reporter who worked at Journatic a decade ago, one of the companies involved here. Today, what is the landscape of this mis and disinformation in the U.S., particularly through this company? What's happening there and who's behind it?
Well, you know, it's interesting because 10 years ago, this seemed like it was on its way out after there was controversy, but Brian Timpone, my former boss, changed the business model. And now it takes dark political money and has this political slant. And because there's not much money in local journalism anymore, but there's plenty of money into politics, there's a lot of political money being thrown at these this pink slime journalism that is made to look like local news. So these kinds of outlets keep springing up all over the place. Now there's hundreds, and it's hard to keep track of who owns what.
Alyssa, I wonder how you've seen, and this is a tease for the next part of our conversation. We need to take a break in a couple of minutes here, but how have you seen these publications being perceived from the people getting them?
It's hard to say what every person's reaction is. Certainly there have been people who have been outraged and who identify them for what they are and, you know, have tried to get the publisher to stop sending them. Unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be any easy to access contact information on many of these. but, you know, we just don't know how other recipients might be perceiving them. Certainly, as you've mentioned, they're designed to look like regular newspapers, and the publishers are taking advantage of the fact that many people trust traditional newspapers and expect them to have certain standards of independent journalism and impartiality. Even if they have a strong political slant, they still expect that they check facts, that they give some credence to other sides, et cetera, the things that we come to associate with trustworthy journalism. And they're taking advantage of that by making these look like these very traditional newspapers with very bland traditional names. So we have to assume that there are many people who see them and don't necessarily recognize them for what they are and think that they're just news.
And we need to take a break. And I know you may have a sort of legal lens on this since you're an attorney as well. But are these political advertisements?
Yeah, it's an extremely complicated question. And there have been a number of complaints against Timponi's companies over the years, alleging that they are political advertisements and that they don't satisfy various disclosure requirements that are associated with political advertisements. It's, I think, as Melita explained, it can often be a very fine line and a blurry one, and to tell what's legitimate political, what's legitimate journalism and what's political advertising, and often sure. It's in the eye of the beholder.
All right, we're going to continue this conversation when we come back, talking more about these so-called pink slime publications, effectively political ads, I'll say it, even though if they're not technically legally political ads, made to look like newspapers. They've been landing in inboxes, mailboxes in Illinois, and we're talking about it today on the show, 800-222-9455. If you want to join our conversation, 800-222-9455. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about a number of publications. They've been arriving in mailboxes in Chicago and the suburbs and elsewhere. And they're made to look like newspapers, but they're not traditional newspapers in the sense of having standards that, you know, attempting to hold themselves accountable for fairness and accuracy. These are more like political messaging tools. Many of them, we mentioned earlier, Governor J.B. Pritzker has characterized the content as racist and right wing. One of the conservative activists, Dan Proft, who's behind them, has fought back against that charge and basically says that, you know, the governor won't engage him on messages of crime and the other topics they're about. They have names like McHenry Times, Kane County Reporter, Chicago City Wire, Shambana Sun, DuPage Policy Journal. They're all part of a company called LGIS, or Local Government Information Services. We're talking about this with Ryan Zitgraff, who is a reporter who about a decade ago worked for a company in this space and was a whistleblower there and coined the term pink slime journalism. And you'll have to listen to the podcast if you missed what that was all about. We're not going to go over that again. But we're also with Alyssa Kaplan, executive director of the nonpartisan, nonprofit advocacy group and research group called Reform for Illinois. Melita Garza is with us, a historian of journalism, associate professor at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. And we are joined now also by Sarah Rafsky, who is a safety and security fellow at the New York Times and a former senior research fellow with the TOE Center. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I understand you recently published an audience study with the TOE Center focused on the way participants in 35 states plus the District of Columbia are interpreting this national network of websites made to look like news sites and publications. Say more about that. What were study participants asked to do?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. And I'll just clarify, first of all, this was a study I did with the TOE Center mostly last year before I joined the Times. So research is not associated with the Times. But I think first maybe I'll like backtrack a second and just highlight the rationale for this, why we were really interested in what readers thought of these sites. And I think it's because the TOE Center has been doing research for roughly the past 3 years examining these pink slime networks that you all have been discussing. And there's been amazing research about their nebulous interconnections, their oblique backing and financial ties, additional great reporting by the Times outlined the extent of their pay-for-play operations. And I think the fear as well as the criticism of these networks has been that they, as many of your guests have discussed, they exploit public trust in local news outlets and information voids left by news deserts, and that readers who are being fed this partisan divisive news disguised as community reporting will conflate the two. But no one had really yet examined how actual news consumers are interpreting these sites and the processes through which they formulate their own opinions around issues like trust and fairness and bias, a lot of the things we've been discussing. So that's really what this study sought to do. you know, the limitations of doing audience research when we're focusing on news consumers is that we cannot definitively reveal the overall intentions of these outlets in their publishing methodologies. But I think by looking at our findings around trust, engagement, and credibility, you'll find some interesting suggestions towards how they function in the news ecosystem. And the way the study worked was, and I should clarify, these were based off of Metric Media's websites rather than the mailed newspapers that you all have been discussing. But we essentially, we picked 90 participants across these 35 states. We assigned them a Metric Media website that fell closest into their geographic area. And we asked them to read these sites for 5 days and record a daily diary exercise, responding to what they were reading on the sites. And then at the end, to give a final assessment about the site's quality, utility, trustworthiness, and fairness. And crucially, at the start of the study, we told them that the purpose of the project was to deepen our understanding of US news audiences' attitudes towards emerging local news websites. We did not reveal that these websites had been accused of being partisan and or inauthentic. That information was disclosed at the conclusion of the study, but while they were reading these websites, they just thought these were new and interesting local news sites. And I think, there were really sort of two key questions to frame these findings, which is, you know, are these sites providing a useful service? Questions about journalism ethics aside, were people learning useful information about their communities? And then the second question was, did readers pick up on this alleged partisan agenda that we all have been discussing, and what did they think about their sites in terms of transparency and bias? And I think to answer that first question regarding the quality of the sites, the answer was a resounding no. By the end of the study, more than two-thirds of participants had formed a negative impression of their assigned websites. And we really found that the more you read, the less you liked it. Some people had a positive impression at the beginning of the study, but by the end, most were really frustrated with these websites, mostly because, at least in the year in which we did the study in 2021, these websites were almost completely static. The above the fold section of the websites, the content basically stopped updating when Joe Biden took office. And people were really frustrated that every day these websites, they were just being asked to read the same articles over and over. Some people even dropped out in frustration. So people were quite annoyed by the end of the study. But I think one thing that was very telling was that the people who liked the website at the onset of the study, in almost all cases, they were responding to what that we call the look and feel of the website. So that is to say, like, they had an easy to navigate layout. They had clean design, in some cases, maybe even superior to their existing local news site. So I do think this highlights that these sites are successful at least mimicking the appearance of traditional news websites.
And not, I can talk a little bit more about terrible ads, maybe the way a lot of local news sites have had to do. Yeah.
Precisely. And I'll stop for a moment to let, you know, some of our other guests speak, but then I can also speak a bit later, maybe about their the perceptions they formed around trustworthiness, fairness, and bias, which were really fascinating as well.
Yeah, well, let's come back to that. And Melita Garza from the University of Illinois, let me ask you, what do you hear there? What do you make of what this says about the news literacy of the, you know, average American, so to speak?
Well, I would start by answering your question with another question. And I was curious, Sarah, whether it's possible that the people that were reviewing these websites might have had a more critical view of them because they were being asked to critique them. In other words, since it was an experiment and not necessarily the way people normally might consume news that they just come across randomly on their computer or makes its way into their mailbox without being primed to think about it in a critical way.
You know, I mean, that's entirely possible. The only thing I can say to that is that I think just anecdotally, based on what I was reading, people actually really were sort of predisposed to give these things a shot, a fair shot. If you read their first impressions and then the first few days of their diary exercises, they're really looking for nice things to say about these sites. They really want to like them. And then just each day, their frustration mounts and mounts.
So Melita, I wonder if you have any perspective on what we've been hearing there, and particularly as it relates to news literacy and you know, or the news deserts, the void that these operations are attempting to fill.
Well, I do actually have some ideas about that. And one thing I think I was struck also by what, and I realize that Sarah is trying to be fair when she said alleged, I think you said alleged bias or what have you, but I think it's pretty clear, at least from what I'm hearing, again, I'm not looking at these myself, so, but from what I'm hearing is that the this is actually fits the definition of propaganda, ideally that it's spreading ideas, information, and rumors for the purpose of helping or injuring an institution, a cause, or a person. The fact that it's that they stopped producing copy when Joe Biden was elected, I think I can see that the people would get frustrated, but wondering if there was any indication from the respondents about whether that made them realize that it in fact might well be propaganda.
So I can maybe respond to that, and that really nicely like leads me to the second section, which was the second half of the study. You know, the first half was focusing on just how they engage with these sites and their thoughts on the quality of the coverage. The second major topic was, you know, what they picked up on in terms of trustworthiness, fairness, and bias. And what was really interesting and perhaps troubling for those who, you know, study media literacy efforts and things like that, the results were much more mixed and in some cases really almost evenly divided. Roughly a third of the participants did at the conclusion of the study determine for themselves that there was a conservative bias in their assigned outlet's editorial coverage, and a smaller number of that third suspected that a partisan organization was responsible in some way. But, you know, back to this point about first impressions, you know, those perceptions of bias really grew over the course of the study upon repeated visits. And I think if you were sort of taking, like zooming out and looking at these sites, what seems probable, particularly when you consider the lack of updated content, is that maybe the ways in which these outlets are supposed to be encountered is not sort of through the habitual, you know, daily reading of what, you know, a lot of local news outlets are trying to do to ensure their financial sustainability. But it's really about if you happen, let's say you Google a local election or a local political figure, and this comes up in your Google search, or it comes up in your social media feed, you click on it, it has all outward appearance of a legitimate news site. And then you read this article and you just don't have any of the context around who is behind this site. And I will just say the final takeaway is that we asked them at the conclusion of the study, if they had thought to look at who was operated or owned the site, and the majority had not, and even admitted they hadn't thought to do so. So I think that has some, you know, really worrisome implications for wider media literacy efforts.
Yeah, it's one thing to read the site every day as you asked your participants to do, and it's another to just have something pop up in your Facebook feed or something like that.
Yeah.
You click on it once and never think about it again. Ryan Zickraff, let me ask you about the partisan aspects of this. We saw it. There was a reporter named James Norman of Shaw Local who had a story on these papers earlier this month, and he talked with State Senator Craig Wilcox, who's a Republican from the town of McHenry, Illinois, and he said the websites counteract what he called a slight bias in the media. And I wonder if you can talk about these publications from the perspective of Republicans or the people that they might be purporting to help.
So I'm sorry, in your question...
Well, I just wonder what do you make of this argument that these news sites are actually filling a need beyond just the idea of the news deserts, that there's, you know, but there's some bias in the media that they're counteracting?
Well, I think one thing that we haven't spoken about, and one of the reasons why they can actually call it journalism is because they do provide like sports scores and lunch menus and things that, especially if you don't have a local news outlet, just doesn't get reported on. So they include a lot of this to disguise, you know, the political bias, even though it is there. But that's part of what makes the pink slime part is you're seeing things that don't have a political agenda, but is packaged together with these political opinions. Now, if you want to talk about, you know, what that bias looks like, yeah, I mean, I would say in general, there are a lot of outlets. I mean, most even local papers have editorials that have a certain perspectives, but that's kind of firewalled from a lot of the editorial coverage, from the regular news coverage. And I think with with these pink slime sites, it's harder to detect.
Yeah. And yeah, I'll say this, I wonder, and maybe Alyssa Kaplan, you might have a perspective on this with Reform for Illinois. Do you see this as something where over time it's going to spread to other partisan perspectives? I mean, will there be a left version of these outlets at some point in the future? Or is there something unique about the particular people who are funding this initiative and we might not see it replicated?
There actually have been some similar types of communications coming from left-leaning organizations, not nearly as widespread as this. I think that's very hard to say. I think, again, as Melita talked about with her example of Ben Franklin, you know, this doesn't necessarily have an ideological, this is not exclusively the realm of one ideology or another. Governor Pritzker, for example, when he has run campaign ads that are also meant to simulate the look of a news item under titles like the Illinois Daily. Of course, the big difference is those are labeled JB for Governor as the committee that paid for them, which is helpful in identifying them as actual ads, unlike these. So I don't think that we can say that this will never arise on the left. We do know that there is a perception on the right, a particular perception on the right, that the media is left-leaning, and that you know, certain news organizations, Fox obviously comes to mind, their purpose is to fill that void. The difference really is, again, do they have journalistic standards? Do they have is their aim to provide news in kind of a consistent, sustainable way? Or is their aim to become most visible around the time of an election and really push a certain candidate or smear a certain candidate with the goal of getting an electoral outcome? So those are the types of issues that you have to grapple with in a legal environment where, you know, the government is understandably very reluctant to chill any kind of speech. And these organizations take advantage of that. And they take advantage of our very complex campaign finance laws to do things like this.
And if I may, there actually is a liberal version of this. I wrote an article for the Washington Post last month, and I mentioned Courier Newsroom, which runs 8 pro-Democratic party news websites in swing states, Arizona, Pennsylvania, stuff like that. It does state news, but from a perspective that supports Democratic politicians.
Interesting. Well, I suspect this is not the last we'll be hearing about publications like this. I want to thank Ryan Zitgraff, Alyssa Kaplan, Melita Garza, and Sarah Rafsky for joining us today here on The 21st Show. Thank you so much for your work and your time.
Thanks
for having us.
Thank you.
Sarah Rafsky is a safety and security fellow with the New York Times Today. She is a former senior research fellow at the Tau Center, which is where she did the research we were talking about earlier. Melita Garza is associate professor in the College of Media at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Ryan Zitgraff is a freelance journalist who coined the term pink slime after blowing the whistle on a company in that space a decade ago. And Alyssa Kaplan is executive director of the advocacy and research organization Reform for Illinois. Coming up after the break, we're going to be talking about a heavy topic, another heavy topic today, and that is death by suicide among veterans and other people associated with the military. The state of Illinois is taking up a challenge to try and prevent that. We're going to talk with one of the leaders of that effort here in Illinois. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.